Hey gang, welcome to another exciting episode of National Google Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. It's the unseasonably warm day of free speech. So what does that mean? I don't know. You figure it out. Anyway, go to republicbroadcasting.org. Click on the donate button. Send the badly needed fundage. Make it your New Year's resolution. Okay, so today we have with us former Louisiana Representative David Duke. Representative Duke, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Dr. Slattery. It's always good.
Okay. So we were talking this week on your show, and we were getting into some Soviet history, Russian history, history of Jewish power in Russia and the Soviet Union, in the Russo-American relationship. And I said that I wanted to at some point focus on the so-called collapse of the Soviet Union, the end of the Soviet Union. And you lived in post-Soviet Russia for several years.
Yeah, 5 years, actually. Yeah.
5 years, okay.
And back and forth for years after that. And I was also, of course, in Ukraine for a couple of years, getting my doctorate at the university over there. And I had a chance to work with people like Solzhenitsyn, and I guess it's important for us to frame it in this. You have all these commentators in the right wing and the left wing who talk about all these things, and they've never really even been there. Some of them maybe have visited there for a week or two, but it's like I live there, and I talked to hundreds of people, and I did a research there, and hundreds of people from those eras. A lot of them were very old, and it gave me a perspective I think that a lot of people don't have, and I think I could speak with a little bit of authority on what actually was going on with how they perceived it under communism and Jewish communism, and how they perceived it in terms of the days of. In fact, I was literally in Russia during the time that the oligarchs were taking over the country. I was there for a while. I didn't spend as long a time, but for a while then, and I was in touch with and talking to and having meetings with many people. And a lot of the people that I've been was talking to, by the way, were really authorities and people that really knew what was happening, including Alexander Solzhenitsyn, as we've talked about repeatedly. So I do feel like I've got some a valuable perspective, and I want to tell you this.
Well, why I invited you on.
And I want to say this to you before we even begin. I want to talk about the fact. I want to say that I really, and I want your listeners to know this. I've met a lot of people over the years, and I've met few individuals who had as much deep knowledge of what Soviet communism was, the history involved in it, and the Cold War period, and then later period. And it's very, very interesting. You also visited there a few times. And it's really fascinating that even though we had very different trajectories in our life, that we came to such similar conclusions. So I just wanted to mention that for the, you know, you don't blow your own horn, even though I think you can play all kinds of musical instruments. But I think it's important that I acquaint your audience with some of your talents and some of your histories.
Yeah. I don't play any wind instruments, but at any rate, and you're not a fluent Russian speaker, but while you were there, you could read Cyrillic with ease pretty well,
yes,
right?
Yes, I could. And I did read a lot of things. I wasn't really a fluent speaker. For me, it's a lot harder to take the spoken language than it is to read language. I think it's probably because when I was in Laos during part of the Vietnam War, and by the way, I wasn't in the military, I will get that clear, but I was teaching Laotian Army officers and Air Force officers, and I flew a lot on these supply missions for, which was done by Air America for the against the Pathay Lao by the Royal Laotian Forces. And I was right next to jet engines, and my hearing is not perfect. I can get by with it, but my tonal qualities aren't very good, and it's very hard for me to do that with language. But I could read a bit, and with the help of my friends, they would always, if we had a discussion in the language, they would always translate a little bit if it became to be more obscure, arcane references that I wouldn't understand. So I definitely enjoyed that, including Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He knew pretty good English himself.
Okay, and then as for myself, as you mentioned, I didn't go to post-Soviet Russia, but I went to the Soviet Union 3 times, and I was there between the putsch. In August, there was the August 1991. There was the attempt to overthrow Mikhail Gorbachev, and then at the end of 1991, they dissolved the Soviet Union. And I was there in between that time, the time when there was supposedly a Soviet collapse. I don't speak Russian. I did study for a couple of years, and but I just never got very good at it. At any rate, this is what I want to talk about, at least I want to start off with, is the term the collapse of the Soviet Union, because it's always rubbed me the wrong way. I'm not exactly sure what people are thinking when they say it. You can have an economy collapse. Well, that's certainly not what was happening. The Soviet economy did not collapse. It was stagnant, but it didn't collapse. When I was there just a couple of months before the Soviet Union dissolved itself, there was goods in the stores. You could buy things. There weren't major shortages. People were working. They weren't starving. They weren't freezing. The economy was functioning more or less as it had been functioning for decades, which was at an adequate level to sustain life. It wasn't like a high consumer society. So it didn't collapse economically. Politically, did it collapse? And if it did collapse, what does collapse really mean? There were power struggles going on. Was it even communism itself that collapsed? I would actually say no, it wasn't communism itself that collapsed. Breaking up the Soviet Union were ethnic rivalries, in particular ethnic independence movements in the three Baltic states, in Georgia, and to a lesser extent, but critically, in
part
Ukraine.
Of the Warsaw Pact and part of the Russian influence.
Well,
in those
areas. The Warsaw Pact was 2 years earlier, where you had the formerly independent, Soviet satellites of Poland and Hungary and Czechoslovakia and Bulgaria and East Germany, where you had them being allowed to go their own way. And those events are often conflated. That's the fall of the Berlin Wall, 1989. And when that happened, Gorbachev was very popular, and he was given a lot of credit for letting this happen, although it did engender the hostility of hardliners in his own government. Mm-hmm. And the events that are called the collapse of the Soviet Union, that was a full 2 years later. So at any rate, that's what I'm saying. Now, you were there at a time when
I was there again in 90, around 95, 96. I was there in, and then of course from around before 2000, just a little bit before 2000. And then I was there through about 2000 and I would say 2003. And so I was there about 5 years.
Okay, so in 1995, in 1995, when you first got there, that would be when the post-Soviet Russian economy had collapsed. It had collapsed. So what were you seeing in 1995 when you first got there in terms of poverty, in terms of...
I saw people really suffering. I mean, it was just amazing. Prices were so cheap. And in fact, there wasn't the restaurants of today there that they have now, but that all changed under Putin, actually. But when the oligarchs ruled this country with an iron fist and just sucked out every ruble from the economy, it was horrible. And I saw people suffering. I went out to actually parts of Siberia, visited friends. A friend of mine's mother and father lived there. And
where did you go in Siberia?
Oh, it was a number of places. Actually, there's so many names, and I got to go back and look at my files. This is 25 years ago, so I got to give you the right places. But a number of places. But it was more or less Russia. I'm not talking about. It wasn't all the way to the West Coast, but it was some of the major cities there in Russia.
Well, Siberia is huge. It's enormous.
Oh yeah,
it's larger than the United States.
Yeah, it's important to point out what part of it more of the more western regions of Siberia, primarily small towns. That's why I just can't think of the name right.
I mean, you got, I think, Tomsk and Omsk and Novosibirsk and places like that in the west.
Yes.
And I went to the eastern part of Siberia, to Irkutsk and to Ulan-Ude and to Khabarovsk, which I guess would still be considered Siberia. Okay, so and so you saw a lot of economic dislocation, a lot of poverty.
Absolutely. I saw a lot of it. I saw teachers, people with PhDs, and they were still working at the university, and there was no money, and they were literally living on the equivalent of about $150 to $200 a month. In fact, many of the Russians, almost any Russian, and this was a common issue, anybody that was kind of middle-class Russian would get a little bit of land in the outskirts, you know, in the countryside. And there, if they lived in apartments, because most people lived in apartments because of the Soviet era, and so they would get a little land, and they would get like a little, maybe a little small shack they'd build, or a small little place they'd build in the summer. Go out there in the summer, and they'd raise vegetables and sometimes even animals or whatever. And they needed that to just, they even have enough to eat. And I remember being out there in this one apartment building, where this the mother of a lady I knew out there, and she just was, again, she was a teacher in university. I think she had, you know, a graduate degree, and she's living in this little apartment, and it was unbelievable because it was like, it's very small. At the end of the hall was a kitchen, and it was a common kitchen for everybody on the floor. And she was telling me, so I was asking, you know, I was one of these people that's always ready to ask a lot of questions. And I asked her so many questions about everything that was going on like that. So, and I was talking to her, and she was telling me, you know, just the change, since the quote democracy came in. And she wasn't actually all that familiar. She didn't even know much of the names of the oligarchs, because the oligarchs at that point were controlling a lot of the media, and they didn't give much publicity. They didn't tell the Russian people, the Jews have taken over your country. And so she didn't have much knowledge about it, but she knew things were tough, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. So regarding the demise of the Soviet Union, this was something that really was not predicted. This was pretty unexpected. I remember the one person I remember who predicted something like this was a French political scientist, a woman named Hélène Terrier-Doncos. And I always thought of her as French. I later found out that she was of Soviet Georgian extraction. I don't know if she was born in France, mm-hmm. or came over as a child or a young woman. Her father was, I guess, a military officer of Soviet Georgian origin. But I read a book.
By the way, before you go further, I just thought about something. Did you tell me that you visited Novosibirsk?
I went through it on the Trans-Siberian Railroad.
Oh, okay.
So I
went there before. I also went to, I'm just trying to think. It's been a long time.
It's a big city, though. It's out there in Siberia.
Yeah.
I mean, the name means New Siberia.
Exactly. Also, in other places like Yekaterinburg, I believe it was.
Yes, Yekaterinburg, which is right there at the edge.
Perm.
And
Novgorod is almost considered like Siberia from the Russians, because it's even though it's just east of Moscow, and like halfway across America, you'd think, but even that's almost considered to them like that. A lot of the a lot of the gulag camps were in places like that as well.
So, let's see, where was I?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry for
being Terrier-Doncos. She had written a book in maybe 1979 or 1980. I read it, I think, in 1982 or 83. It made a huge impression on me. It was called The Decline of an Empire. Mm-hmm. And in it, she predicted that the rising birth rates in the Muslim areas, in particular in Central Asia, also in Azerbaijan,
mm-hmm.
because there are six Muslim republics, or at least nominally Muslim republics, that those rising birth rates would lead to independence movements in those Muslim republics that would pull apart the Soviet Union. Now, actually what happened was those six republics, they were all more or less orphaned. They did not have independence movements, but the white Christian minorities mm-hmm. were the ones who were, you know, in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Georgia, and eventually in Ukraine, that these yeah. were the ones that were that pulled apart the Soviet Union. So it was an ethnic thing. It certainly wasn't an economic thing, even though the Soviet economy, like I say, it didn't collapse, but it didn't function at a very high level either.
This is one reason why a lot of the so-called right or so-called conservatives and white nationalists don't really understand what the Russians were facing. I mean, the part of the Russian population is like scattered. Some areas of the country are very Russian. Some of the areas of the country are Muslim and not Russian. I mean, you have Kazakhstan that has a huge border, you know, obviously with traditional Russia, huge border. I mean, you got Uzbekistan's below that. I believe Turkmenistan is on the Caspian. I mean, there's just so much we could talk about there. And the Russians knew. I mean, the Jews are globalists, and they affect all countries, and they try to control all country with their banking and their influence and their monetary policy and the World Monetary Fund and everything like that. And the Russians realized that they had to create a sort of a recognition of the different nationalities that were in part of the political union or the political associations that they had later, you know, like when the Russian Federation and beyond. And so they had to do this. So they, at the same time, they wanted to preserve the Russian people. At the same time, they really had to say that they respected the traditions, the faith, the principles, all the interests of all those other people. But we were an alliance, right, against the whatever the globalists, I guess the best way you could say it. So this is what Russia was facing. If they wouldn't have kept control of those countries, and you couldn't do it, you can't do it by iron fist and just repressing them. Even the Soviets knew that. Even during the Soviet era, when the Jews controlled the Soviet Union, they had an iron fist over the country, but they always promoted the languages of their people there, even though they wanted to teach them Russian too. They promoted their heritage. They tried to put as many of those people as they could in power in those representative satellite governments. And so this was not a betrayal of the Russian people for the Russian government to do that. It was just a tactical, pragmatic issue, because if all of these became NATO havens and powerfully controlled by, you know, the Jewish controlled West, because Russia was no longer Jewish controlled. That Russia had a great relationship when Jews controlled the Soviet Union. As Jews lost control of the Soviet Union, that's when the entire process in Russia started to become hated. They went from a special and favored nation trade status, as we know, in the 1930s, even while they were killing millions of people, and they had killed millions of Christians, to the point now, of course, Russia's being sanctioned, and it's an anti-communist Christian country. You can't kind of make these things up, can you?
Right, and I just because I'm a nerd, I want to get perfectly accurate on things. So yeah. In 1917... you had two revolutions in Russia. I guess the first one's called the March Revolution, which mm-hmm. did take place in February.
And then the October Revolution, of course.
And then the October Revolution. They were on a different calendar at the time, but the first revolution overthrew the Tsar. The Tsar right. went into exile, and you had the provisional government. And then the second revolution is where Lenin and the Bolsheviks were able to take power in right. And that was in a Russia that had lost the Tsar.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, no child left behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing. knowledge, and knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. While we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country, here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store or call us.
800-724-2719, extension 3. 800-724-2719, extension 3.
Lenin and the Bolsheviks were able to take power in, right. And that was in a Russia that had lost the Tsar, but was still fighting in World War One, a war that had become very, very unpopular. And the unpopularity of the war was instrumental in the Bolshevik takeover, because the Bolsheviks then immediately withdrew from the war. And in withdrawing from the war, first of all, the Bolsheviks didn't even control a lot of Russia. They controlled the areas around St. Petersburg / Lenin, which became Leningrad, and Moscow and the core of Russia. But a lot of other areas of Russia really were not under the control. And then, big areas of, say, what's now Georgia, Azerbaijan, Armenia, weren't really under their control. They set up some sort of Transcaucasian Republic. Ukraine was, for a while, not under their control. Yeah. So they lost an awful lot of territory. And then, of course, countries that we don't really even associate with Russia much anymore. Finland, in particular. Finland had been part of the Russian Empire. And it gained its independence in the wake of the Russian, so-called Russian Revolution, and has remained independent ever since.
That's
Poland,
true.
Poland was, at least big hunks of Poland, were part of the Russian Empire. Some hunks of it were part of the German Empire, but it was largely part of the Russian Empire. And Poland emerged as a its own country after World War One, and it has remained such, although it was a Russian Soviet satellite after World War Two. The Soviet Union itself only just marked the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Soviet Union. It was actually founded in December 1922. What had emerged from the Bolshevik takeover for 5 years was the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic, RSFSR, and the Soviet Union was a union of the Russian Federated Soviet Socialist Republic and Ukraine, Belarus, and this Transcaucasian Republic. And they, in Lenin's more or less dying days, when he had already had his stroke, this was put together, and that's the Soviet Union. And later, territory was added to it after World War One. I'm sorry, after World War II, because as a result of World War One, they had lost the three Baltic republics of Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. Those were independent republics between the two world wars. They were members of the League of Nations and all of that. And then after they were incorporated into back into or they were incorporated into the Soviet Union during World War II, remained there. And the Soviet Union also picked up territory on its European borders and picked up Moldova and like that. So anyway, I just wanted to get nerdy about that for a while.
By the way, I, as a footnote, we're really going into the weeds here historically, but maybe it's important. This is kind of a good show, and I think these shows are something maybe in years from now, if we ever win this battle ahead to overthrow this Jewish tyranny over the country, people might even go back to these archives and some of these programs and learn some of the things that we knew and some of the things that were known. Since we're talking a little bit about the overthrow of Russia, and I know you studied this as well, okay? So the truth is that the Bolsheviks, the paving of the way for the Bolsheviks was originally created by the Mensheviks, and Jews had taken over the parliament. Just like you got Republicans and Democrats in the Congress, you got Schumer running the Democrats, right? And you have all those Jews, of course, obviously in the House of Representatives. You've got Adam Schiff, you had Nadler, you had Engel at the time of the impeachments, and you've got massive influence over the intelligence and so forth of this country. The real first power, the fact the guy that abolished the Pale Settlement was limiting the Jewish settlement in Russia at the time, and that was something that the czars of Russia created because they knew the Jews were very exploitative of the Russian peasants. In fact, one of the reasons they hated the czar so much was the May Laws, and I think it was in the 1880s. And the May Laws were a very interesting thing. They were certainly considered anti-Semitic, but if you read the May Laws themselves, and I've read them and translations as well as the Russian, but the May Laws they went to great length talking about the peasants of Russia and how they were being exploited by the Jews. They also talked some about the exploitation that existed in the aristocrats, and the Tsar worked very, very hard to have a lot of reforms. In fact, that took place all during the 19th century of the aristocrat landowners to make sure that they were fair and decent and taking away a lot of the serfdom restrictions that they had. But it was really interesting. I can give a good example that's just like today with the kind of the disinformation they give us, right? So before the Bolsheviks came, right, the guy that abolished Russia's Pale Settlement, and the guy who was a socialist and basically a Marxist but not a Bolshevik, his name was Kerensky, and interestingly enough, it's kind of crazy, but you still have publications that say, oh, down with the Jew Kerensky was the placard against these people. Now, by the way, he really paved the way for the Bolsheviks, but anyway, and they would say down with Kerensky.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Are you one of the millions of people who feel like there is a dark cloud hanging over their heads whenever they're using pharmaceutical drugs? For some, the short-term relief can turn into an opioid addiction nightmare. Have you ever wondered why CBD oil is a billion-dollar industry? It's because it works better than opioids and is actually healthy for you. However, CBD oil is stripped of all other helpful compounds found in the hemp plant. According to neuroscientists, the whole hemp plant, otherwise known as hemp paste, is even more effective than the chemically processed CBD oil. Are you ready to take back your health? You can try hemp paste by going to rbnhemppaste.com. That's rbnhemppaste.com.
Hello, I'm Dr. Leonard Horowitz. I was right 30 years ago in warning the world about threatening lab virus outbreaks, AIDS, and Ebola. I was right 20 years ago when FBI Director Robert Mueller made me a suspect in the anthrax mailings because I warned the Bureau before the CIA's biocrime and Cipro sales psyops happened. I was right about COVID-19 being an AIDS-laced mutagen plan to resurge this fall to excuse officials' profitable depopulation globalization agendas. And I was right about the only safeguards being antioxidants and holy spiritual sustenance. Vitamin C, D, zinc, chlorophyll, oxygen, and oxysilver especially transmits the frequency resonance to neutralize the expanded function bioweapon. Oxysilver is a double superconductor of the healing power of love. It is the first nutraceutical invented to amplify prayer power and the faithful, loving intention of your heart. Buy, try, and stockpile OxySilver through HealthyWorldStore.com.
Extendivite testimonials on Amazon are very informative. Here's just a few. Amazon customer, 5 stars. Honestly, this stuff works. Nick, easy to take capsules. For those who can't handle the liquid drops, easy-to-take Extendivite capsules do the same job. Karoka Fam, works great. Like Extendivite very much. Seems to work as advertised. Thanks. Arlene, 5 stars. Love this product, Extendivite. Terry W, 5 stars. Can't say enough. Great product. Freya, 5 stars. I just ordered another. To get your Extendivite today, go to extendivite.com. That's extendivite.com. Or call us at 1-877-928-8822.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
This is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing, nothing without a woman or a girl.
And with the Jew Kerensky was the placard against these people. Now, by the way, he really paved the way for the Bolsheviks. But anyway, and they would say, down with Kerensky. Well, if you read, you can read all kinds of articles that are saying that, oh, Kerensky was accused of having Jewish ancestry, but Kerensky had no Jewish ancestry. And again, when I started investigating myself this, especially I was reading about this a lot when I was in Russia because I wanted to understand this from people in Russia and people who knew Russian history the best. So I started looking, and then and also, of course, I always go to the Jewish sources, right? So the IJN, which is a, you know, Russian Revolution, which is absolutely a Jewish organization, Jewish women created and so forth. And it's all about Jews. They actually say in their own publications, yes, Kerensky, whose father was Jewish. So he definitely, and it says whose father was Jewish, had sympathized with the Jews. That's what they said, I think, in the articles and stuff that I read. And they were, who were severely persecuted by the Tsarist regime. So the idea that Kerensky was a Jew, he wasn't a religious Jew from what I can see, but he definitely identified with the Jews. And he worked with all the other Jewish communists, and ultimately he paved the way for the Bolsheviks to take power. What do you think about that? What do you know about the Mensheviks and that type of thing?
So the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks had originally been part of the same party. And
exactly.
The word simply means – the Bolshevik means the majority faction. The Mensheviks means the minority faction, because at one particular meeting, that's the way it broke down. But by the by these revolutions, they were functioning as completely separate parties. And the Mensheviks were much larger, even though they're technically called the minority faction, they were much larger than the Bolsheviks.
By the way, just to say, I just want people to understand when I say things about these histories, and they go against some of the thing. I mean, I read an article in Wikipedia one time that was saying that that in Wikipedia it says that Alexander Kerensky wasn't a Jew at all. had no Jewish, not of Jewish ancestry. His mother's maiden name was, by the way, his mother's name was Adler, which is, you know, which could easily be German Christian as well as Jewish, right? But it's really interesting. So, but then over the years, I looked at Jewish publications, which were very, very, the Jews are really, really cautious. They really want to know who's a Jew and who's not a Jew and who has Jewish descent and who doesn't have a Jewish descent, right? So, so I'm looking. In fact, I even found an article in 2015 a while back. You know, this is 1885. A Jew becomes leader of Russia, if not for long, right? So, I mean, it's really interesting to see this and how this disinformation, when your Jews control the media and they control the popular media for the goy, the only thing you have the choice to, that's why my book, My Awakening, goes to Jewish sources primarily. Most of my sources in my books come from Jewish sources themselves, because, you know, that's the only way you can find out the truth about Jews is to go to Jewish books and Jewish newspapers. I mean, literally the article, if I remember the title of it, it was like, a Jew becomes leader of Russia, if not for long, right?
So you had these two revolutions, in 1917. That's in the height of the World War I, which ended in an armistice in late 1918. And all the major countries of the world viewed this revolution with great alarm, right? I mean, eventually the United States got friendly with Bolshevik Russia, but initially, even the United States they participated in what's called the Allied intervention, where primarily the Allied countries of World War II intervened and tried to fight along with the White Russians against the Bolsheviks, or at least be some sort of bulwark against the Bolsheviks. And Germany obviously was not an allied country, but Germany also intervened, and I believe it took over part of Ukraine for a while, because Ukraine was a great source of agricultural resources that were badly needed during the war. But you had it was a really, really large operation. You had maybe 5,000 American troops, and they were in the Far
Siberia
East,
primarily, yeah.
Yeah, Far East, but also in
they were aiding to a degree the White Russians.
Right, they were aiding the White Russians. The Allies were on the side of the White Russians and the anti Bolshevik Russians, who some of them were they were czarist, others were whatever, but they were anti Bolshevik. And so you had American troops in Vladivostok, in I believe in Archangel, which is up by the Arctic Ocean and north of Russia. You had 50,000 Japanese troops. 50,000, that's a large number. You had British troops who were in Crimea. Lloyd George eventually took them out because they were starting to adopt Bolshevik views on things. They said, if we don't pull out of Crimea, we're going to wind up with a Soviet in London, meaning like a Soviet takeover of London, because they were being indoctrinated with this. You had Turkey, or the Ottoman Turks were participating. And oddly enough, even though Czechoslovakia wasn't a country yet, there were 50,000 Czechs who were occupying eastern Siberia.
Wow.
And it's a really interesting story. I won't go into it in detail, but these have been Czech prisoners of war. And when Lenin withdrew Russia from the war, they said, well, we want to go fight the Austrian Empire. We want to fight for Czech independence. And he said, you're welcome to do it, but you're not doing it on the Eastern Front. If you want to fight on the Western Front, go ahead. And he put them on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Mm-hmm. And then they were going across the Trans-Siberian Railroad. And then he started thinking, wait a minute, these people got weapons. We don't like that. So they tried to disarm them. And the 50,000 Czechs can't be wrong. They wouldn't be disarmed. And they just took over eastern Siberia for several months, eventually gave it to the Japanese. And then they went on their merry way across the world, across the United States, and fought on the Western Front. But it was a massive intervention. In the wake of this, of course, there was a lot of death and starvation. And when the Bolsheviks cemented power, during this time, during the Civil War, they implemented what they called war communism, which just meant that the Bolsheviks could come in, requisition whatever they wanted from whomever they wanted. And it was a reign of terror. And there was massive human tragedy, and there was a resulting famine. And the last point I want to make, I think it was the early 1920s, the United States, which did not recognize the Bolshevik government until the early 30s, but it did send over later to become president Herbert Hoover. Herbert Hoover went over. He was a noted engineer, and he oversaw relief efforts, famine relief efforts, mm-hmm. in Russia. So,
By the way, it's I think it's we're kind of diving into the minutiae here, but I hope people can get the basic understanding of what's really critical here that's never talked about by our forces that basically give us the history of the world today, the people that control history. Like Orwell said, he who controls the past controls the future. And so you talked about, the American Expeditionary Forces in Russia. And it is true that there were Americans there, and they were supporting the White Russians. And this is when America was – this is before America was really completely taken over by Jews. They were starting to influence Wilson even at much of this time. But they influenced Wilson to get into the First World War, and they had Jews all around, and they got Brandeis appointed to the Supreme Court, and on and on. They started their influence. But in the early 1920s, that was long before the establishment of the OSS, right, in the Second World War, long before the CIA. The people that did our intelligence network at the time were the U.S. military, and it was U.S. military intelligence in Russia that was in during the revolutionary period was really kind of defending the interests of the West and the interests of Christianity and the interests of Western civilization from what they saw as a threat of communism. And they recognized, by the way, and it's very important. Now, one of the trajectories of my life which made huge difference to me was I read about the fact that in the National Archives, it had the communications between the top chief of staff of the U.S. Army Intelligence, right, and was the guy that was really in charge of the operations in Russia, one of the highest positions anyway, was Captain Montgomery Schuyler. And Schuyler sent back reports, which are all in the National Archives, which you can dig up. And I read about this, and I wanted to see the reports myself. So I actually contacted my U.S. representative at the time. My father knew some of these people. And then he sent me the he dug up the documents from his office, and they sent them to me. And when you read these reports, you get a glimpse into this historical period that few Americans are aware of. They reported the horrible massacres of thousands of Russian aristocrats and intelligentsia murdered simply because they, could provide effective leadership in opposition to the communists, which were really led by Jews overwhelmingly. A lot of Americans are somewhat aware of Stalin's murder of civilians. However, millions died in the early Bolshevik times. And one of the classic things I know by heart, because I learned this so well back in the early 60s when I first found these things. And this comes from what he's quoting here is from an article by Robert Wilton, correspondent of the London Times, one of the most prestigious papers in the world, who was the their reporter in Russia that was privy to all of these different things. And I remember this is what is also quoted by Schuyler to the American government. And it goes that somewhat to the effect that I can't get every word proper. But he said, a table made up in 1918 by Robert Wilton, correspondent of the London Times, showed that that time, I'm trying to remember this with my old brain, there were like 380 commissars, maybe different, I don't know, something similar to that number, including even a couple Negroes, 13 Russians, Chinamen, I don't remember that number, some Armenians, and more than 300 Jews. And the latter number, that most of these Jews that came to Russia came from the United States, as had Trotsky. From the United States, it's a downfall of the imperial government. Pretty shocking stuff. And the other quote I do remember very clearly is the one he stated. He said, it's probably unwise to say this loud in the United States, but the Bolshevik movement is and has been since its beginning guided and controlled by Russian Jews. And this is what he said, which is shocking, which is one reason why I remember it, because it's pretty funny in a way. It's been from the beginning, it's been guided by Russian Jews of the greasiest type.
Yeah.
That's literally from the letters from the National Archives to the President of the United States. Mm-hmm. And then you had the ambassador to Russia at the time was David Francis. And he wrote back to the country, to the government of our country, when America was free, when America was controlled not by Jews, but by, by Europeans and European Christians, the Bolshevik leaders, most of them whom were Jews, what he said, 90% of whom were returned exiles care little for Russia or any other country, but are internationalists, and they are trying to start a worldwide communist revolution. Pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, you know? and they were trying to start a worldwide communist revolution. Now, we only have limited time left.
Sure.
There's one other important point I wanted to get to.
Social Marxism, that's what we want to talk about, right?
Well, no, I don't want to get to cultural Marxism, actually. I want to get to the role of Jewish power at different parts of the Soviet Union, in particular in the breakup. But so, you know, as what you just read, that spells out that that Bolshevik Russia, that, early years after the revolution, this was very, very much dominated by Jews. Although there were non-Jews involved, but the Jews were dominant. And
by the way, the non-Jews like Bakunin were much more moderate and decent, and they didn't want the pogroms, and they didn't want the mass murder and the gulags. Go ahead.
So, Stephen F. Cohen wrote that in the 1920s, you had three factions in the communist leadership. You had a Jewish faction, which certainly was dominant early on. You had a Russian faction, which was obviously smaller, and that was centered around Bukharin. And you had a Transcaucasian faction that was centered around Stalin. And there was a small number of Georgians and Armenians who were part of this faction. But certainly in the 20s, the Jewish faction was dominant. The collectivization of agriculture was something which led to the mass famine and which is known as the Holodomor. The collectivization of agriculture was pushed by the Trotsky and the Jewish faction, and it was something that had been opposed by Bukharin and originally had been opposed by Stalin. But
and these Jews wanted the money. They wanted the money to get that, because that's from the foreign exchange, from confiscating and stealing the wheat and everything, of the most prosperous wheat basket of Europe and Ukraine. They wanted that money too. So it was about killing them also, but it was also about an ethnic change in the country. That these Jews themselves, that we have documents for, Solzhenitsyn showed me some, they were absolutely looking to change the demographics of Ukraine.
So that was early. That was early Soviet Union history. And then In the 30s and the 40s, you had some sort of gradual purge of Jews. I mean, by 1940, when Trotsky was assassinated by agent of Stalin in Mexico City in 1940, that marked the last. Trotsky was the last surviving member of the early Soviet Politburo. All of them had died. All of Stalin's colleagues in the early Soviet Politburo had died, mostly executed by him. And so at some point, it's exactly when this was going on, it's hard to say, but at some point, the Jewish power had been replaced. And so by the time Stalin died, the Soviet Union was no longer under Jewish power. There was this legacy of what you could call Jewish insanity, that the programs, the structures, the economic structures and the political structures that had been built up in the early Soviet Union, they survived the non-Jews who were running the Soviet Union under Khrushchev, under Brezhnev, under Gorbachev. They had inherited these, and they were a product of them, and it was extreme. It was almost an existential dependence that they had on them, because their own legitimacy was based on them. So they couldn't really replace this. It was very difficult to replace the structure. Well, finally, Gorbachev tried to replace the structures. And the point I want to make in our final minutes is I think that the actual breakup of the Soviet Union had little direct involvement from Jews, that the problems of the Soviet Union were a result of policies Jews had put in place, policies and institutions and structures they'd put in place early on, but were no longer running. And as Gorbachev attempted to reform those structures and those policies, he came into a bunch of resistance, not from Jews, but from people whose own power, own legitimacy was based on them. And that the breakup of the Soviet Union itself had very little to do with Jews, but it created a massive vacuum in, the end of 1991, going into 1992, and that vacuum was absolutely exploited by well-placed Jews within the system who had connections with extremely rich Jews outside of the system, outside of the country, and they were able to take over and massively exploit and, you know.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's...
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT-TODAY.
Tune in Saturday mornings, 8 to 10 Central, to the Alternative Media with your host, Farron. If you've not been listening, this is some of what you've been missing.
2,000 mules, like you like to say occasionally, Farron, in your face.
They might have a set of lactating mammaries available that could provide milk for their adopted children.
Listen, news media, all pulling off this gigantic fraud.
Rhino, neocon, cucks.
There's this wonderful thing that's called Vote With Your Feet. Move to California.
I am a conspiracy factualist and everyone else is a reality theorist.
Hundreds, if not thousands, of ships came out of nowhere.
Give me liberty or let's give you death.
Any excuse to go in and kill yourself for this fraud of a government. This goes back 100 years.
When they come for your gold, give them a lead. And when they come for your guns, give them the bullets first. And God help us all.
In times like these, you can't depend on the government to keep you warm and fed. But you can depend on the Vermont Bun Baker to do just that. With a Vermont Bun Baker, you'll never be in a situation where you can't cook, bake, fry, boil water, or heat your home all at the same time. One of the most revolutionary cook stoves, wood stoves ever, the Vermont Bun Baker is available with or without soapstone veneer, a natural stone that retains heat and radiates it back into the room once the fire is out. A beautiful addition to your home, the Vermont Bun Baker has an efficiency rating well above 75% and qualifies for the wood stove tax credit. For more information, watch the Vermont Bun Baker on YouTube and live stream or visit us at www.vermontwoodstove.com. You can also reach us by calling 1-866-SOAPSTONE. Don't ever be hungry or cold because the power's gone out. With a Vermont Bun Baker, all you have to worry about is what's for dinner.
With extremely rich Jews outside of the system, outside of the country, and they were able to take over and massively exploit and, you know, the post-Soviet Russia. That's my position. What are your thoughts on that before we wrap up?
You know, we've talked a lot about the hive mind. I agree with you fundamentally that there were a lot of factors of the structure of the government of Russia and a lot of false economic structures that didn't really work that well for the economy and all these other things. But there's no question in my mind that the Jewish hive mind globally was already hateful toward Russia. That's one reason. And we saw that change take place, you know, beginning early in the 1950s, started getting in more and more momentum in the 60s and 70s. And by the time that the Soviet state was falling, there was a lot of hatred of Jews globally, and the powerful financial forces that were absolutely trying to exacerbate any way they could, any influential way, the destruction of really the entire Russian state, because they knew the Russian state under the present composition of the quote party, which had expelled basically most of the Jews from all the incredible important positions, that the more there was chaos in Russia and the more there was economic disaster, the more they had the chance to take over and control the so-called democracy. And there was a huge red mafia, a Jewish mafia that existed, and they, which they built up secretly in those years. And they already infected and corrupted the state. So they had this apparatus in place that as soon as power broke down and the so-called Russian Empire broke down, as soon as that broke down, then they were able to exploit it. And so I agree with you fundamentally. At the same time, it was, I do believe that, you know, they exacerbated it and they definitely moved to take it over. And they already had a deep hatred of not communism per se, and a lot of them were still attached to communism in 1950, Jewish people. I mean, the Rosenbergs were spying and selling out of secrets to Russia, even I guess 54, whatever, they were convicted of spying for Russia. But the internals of Russia, by 1954, the Jews were out of the power of Russia. They used Jewish spies, but because Jews had a very long connection, a very long spiritual kind of connection with the early Bolsheviks, which they admired, and especially Trotsky. But ever since the assassination of Trotsky by Stalin and the government and the losing of Jewish control there, I think they developed more and more of a realization that the profile of what was the Soviet Union had slipped from a Jewish society, controlled society, to a Gentile controlled society. And of course, during the 1950s, to show you this change, all the prohibitions against the Orthodox Church were eliminated. There was no repression of Christianity. They even started allowing the church to really expand in the 1960s, dramatically, 70s, 80s. By the time 80s rolled around, they were expanding. And then, of course, when Putin finally came into power, he orchestrated and supported not only the rebuilding of the Church of the Savior, the ancient Christian cathedral in Moscow, but literally 50,000 new churches, Russian Orthodox, were, of course, obviously completely non-Jewish, very Christian, and had a long history of opposing Jews because their own priests and their own people suffered so greatly from the Jews under communism. So well, those are just, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a very good summation. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Duke.
I'm glad I could add to the discussion with a little bit of my knowledge over these years.
Okay, great. And I will be back again next week with more exciting episodes of National Bugle Radio.
American Freedom News is your daily website that will keep you fully informed on what both the good guys and bad guys are doing in the information war in which we are all engaged. Fed up with the lies of the fake news media and the censorship of big tech giants? American Freedom News is the solution, as we provide truth and knowledge on all the vital issues of the day. American Freedom News believes in America first. The establishment wants us split into numerous hostile groups rather than uniting in a common cause against the corrupt oligarchy that is plundering America and the world. Many more Americans are waking up and realizing they are the victims of the ongoing Great Replacement and Great Reset. But the malevolent forces trying to systematically destroy America can and will be defeated. Be fully informed by reading American Freedom News, the best news and information site on the internet. Go to AmericanFreedomNews.us and find out for yourself. That's AmericanFreedomNews.us.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.